thank you so much for coming to our event today on the rise and impact of Chindia, sponsored by the Freeman Chair Program in China Studies here at CSIS. The term Chindia is credited to Jairam Ramesh, who is an Indian politician, and he wrote a book entitled Making Sense of Chindia. And this book describes the histories of China and India and examines the emergence of these two great nations amid the forces that are being unleashed of both globalization and liberalization in India. And Ramesh maintains that there's great potential for these two countries, China and India, to collaborate, and thereby making their roles more important on the world stage. As we all know, China and India are moving towards becoming the biggest economies in the world. Their populations comprise together 2.4 billion people, about 40% of the world's population, and their annual growth rates now are between 8% and 10%. I think it remains somewhat controversial whether we can combine these two countries into a single term or think about them together. And that's one of the things that I think our speakers will be talking about today. The National Intelligence Council published a report in their series on mapping the global future, which seeks to predict the global landscape and in 2020. And one of the issues that it identifies as the key on one of the key uncertainties in the future development of the international system is whether or not China and India rise smoothly. And the report compares the impact of the emergence of these two great nations with the advent of a united Germany in the 19th century and a powerful United States in the early 20th century, in terms of the likely impact that these countries have had on the geopolitical landscape. And so it sees, again, the rise of China and India as having this kind of great potential in the future. So with that short introduction, I'm going to turn to first our main speaker, who will be Professor Zhao Gancheng, and we are really quite privileged to have him here, not only to speak with us today, but also as a visiting fellow for 3 months in the Freeman Chair Program. Professor Zhao heads the South Asia Program at the Shanghai Institute for International Studies, where he has been since 1985 and has done extensive research and writing on South Asia. And then commenting on Professor Zhao's presentation, we have Ambassador Schaefer, who many of you here know, who heads our South Asia program at CSIS, and I think has been with us for about 10 years after a very impressive 30-year career in the Foreign Service and formerly served as Ambassador of Sri Lanka. So with that, I think we'll start with Professor Zhao.
Thank you very much, Bernie and Ambassador Schaefer, for giving me this wonderful opportunity to share with distinguished scholars here some of my thoughts on China-India relations. That is something I've been engaged in studying for many, many years. However, that does not look like a legitimate subject in a U.S. think tank, because basically, fundamentally speaking, Sino-India relations is none of American business. And who cares here in Washington, D.C.? Whatever you do, whatever you want to do, we don't care. And therefore, it's not easy here to find the scholars or professionals in the U.S. think tanks really focusing, interested in Sino-India relations. And perhaps Professor John Garber is the only exception. And he produces a very wonderful book on the protracted rivalry, and which is seen in China as a very important reference book about American perspective. But anyway, it's not a vice versa situation. For instance, in China, it's very easy to find professionals who are interested in U.S.-India relations. And also in the India think tanks in New Delhi, you may find a number of professionals, experts, using their expertise to study Sino-American relationship. So this is an asymmetrical situation, perhaps a reflection of the fact that the United States today is the hegemonic power, and the hegemonic power only cares about itself. And so this is the first point, the first remark I want to say. And secondly, whether we have to ask whether Sino-India relationship, its development is really irrelevant to the United States. Perhaps not necessarily, because let me give you an example. Condoleezza Rice, when she was still the professor at Stanford, she wrote a very important article in January, February, Foreign Affairs, 2000, year 2000, in which she argued that United States would consider India always in the context of India-Pakistan competition and also the nuclear rivalry. However, she argues that India has been remaining as a very important factor in the Chinese strategic consideration. And starting from this, United States might have to redefine India's position and role in the international system. And to what extent Ms. Rice or Secretary Rice's argument has a very important impact on the U.S. later on shift of its policy towards India. That is worth studying. However, one thing is quite for sure that if United States really want to work out a proper India policy, perhaps you may need a little more knowledge about what's going on between China and India. That's a beginning word I want to say. And now let me turn to the Chindia, the term. What is the real meaning of Chindia? As Bonnie just said, Chindia is a term created by an India politician. Mr. Ramesh now is the State Minister of Commerce. And before that, when the Congress Party was in opposition, he had been engaged in the China studies for many years. In the year 2003, just on the eve of Congress Party coming to power again, he published a book, as you explained. He put forward the concept of Chindia. And this book is soon introduced to China and translated into Chinese and getting very popular among the Chinese readers. And last year, there was a major gathering in China, in Shenzhen, the southern city of China, about 100 professionals and analysts on South Asia affairs to discuss many issues. So, and one of the heated discussed subjects was what is the meaning or implication of Chindia to China. And we had a very heated debates among the scholars and without any conclusion. And we have two extremes, basically. On the one end, some people, optimistic views, argue that because China and India are both are civilized, a very old ancient civilization in Asia, and therefore we share a lot of common grounds and common interests. We should forget about the past episode, unpleasant episode, and we should solve our existing problems so that the two countries can unify themselves into a very important force in the international system. And we should address all these existing problems. Sounds like very easy to do so. Okay, this is one extreme. On the other end, another extreme is a pessimistic view, which says that it is not possible for China and India to solve their problems because of geopolitical reasons. The two Asian giants must be in a competitive scenario and context. There is no, virtually, frankly, there is no possibility for the two countries to address their existing problems. So there, on that particular gathering, there is no substantial conclusion. I guess my personal view is the reality might be just in between, neither this end nor that end. It is in between, and it's not a really official wishful thinking only from some scholars. There is some kind of substantial ground for the two Asian giants to do something to move ahead. because basically my argument is that Chindia is a two-level issue, two-level problems. One is a bilateral interrelations. The other is what is the relationship between the two developing powers and the international system. So my draft start my remarks on the possible impact of Chindia on the international system. However, today I would like, I'm going to start my remarks on the bilateral. And what is the meaning, what is the implication of Chindia to the Sino-India relationship, which has been experiencing over the past 60 years. This bilateral relationship has been full of all kinds of events, all kinds of conflicts, and all kinds of friendships. We can say, and in one period, we call each other as brother. On the other period, we call each other as a hostile enemy. All kinds of things. So how to work out, how to perceive this bilateral relationship in a general framework, I try to work that out, and my general framework is, in my personal view, I think, basically, we can describe this bilateral relationship or its development into a pair of threes, the three major conflicts and the three major rounds of rapprochement or reconciliation. And the three major conflicts, one, the first one was Tibet. When China sent its troop in October 1950 by peaceful way into Tibet, there was a major debate among the cabinet ministers in India, how to deal with that issue. And some hardlines and some tough people advocated some sort of a war, even a fighting at least against China, and in order to save Tibet. Among the minds of some Indians, they believe that saving Tibet is a part of India's obligations. And that debate lasted a little more than 1 or 2 months. And finally, Prime Minister Nehru concluded that India could not afford a real war or fight with China. And even if India could afford that, India could not save Tibet. So that's the precise word the Prime Minister Nehru used, save in Tibet. And that was the first conflict. Of course, this conflict lasted roughly about 2 years. In 1954, the two countries reached the first round of rapprochement. That is, in 1954, Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai visited India, and with Prime Minister Nehru issued a very important joint statement in which China and India declared the five principles of peaceful coexistence. That is later on becoming the guideline of China's foreign policy. And the second major conflict, of course, was 1962, border wars, border conflict. And this border war, I'm not going to, because I don't have enough time to elaborate all these things. Just simple sketch out the basic picture of this war. And this war started from a mutual tough positions, I would say. And the Indians, of course, by that time had a very tough position against the Chinese way, against the Chinese view on all these disputed area or disputed territory. And this disputed territory is a large piece. It's not a small piece, very large, altogether involving 130,000 square kilometers, divided into three parts. The eastern sector is about 90,000 square kilometers, and China claims that it is part of China. And the western sector takes about 38,000 square kilometers under the Chinese control, but India claims it is part of Kashmir. And the third part is the central sector. It's that's relatively small, and about 2,000 square kilometers. And these three parts made the two sides very, very difficult to make necessary concessions. And China tried to reach a package deal with India. In 1960, the Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai paid his last visit to New Delhi, tried to talk with Prime Minister Nehru. But all the Chinese demands were turned down. And the Chinese faced a situation whether Chinese would withdraw, retreat or not. If you don't retreat, then you have to prepare for a war, for a conflict. So that is the real, I would say, triggering reasons why the two countries finally burst into a real armed conflict. This is a second conflict. This conflict lasted actually very long, and the two countries withdrew their respective ambassadors until 1976. And Indira Gandhi, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, decided to resend her ambassador back to China. And in 1979, the then Indian Foreign Minister Vajpayee visited Beijing. That was the beginning of the second round of rapprochement, lasting for 10 years until 1988. In December, the Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi paid a very important milestone, I would say, historical visit to Beijing. And Deng Xiaoping had a very comprehensive talks with the Indian Prime Minister. And Deng Xiaoping offered a very interesting solution to the boundary issue, that is, a package deal. And Deng Xiaoping never elaborated what the package deal should contain, what is the details. But the package deal itself is a very nice expression and showing the Chinese desire to solve this lasting problem. But unfortunately, by that time, India was not ready to solve this problem. So India basically, or frankly, turned down all the Chinese demands. So, but it did not prevent the development of the second round of rapprochement. And the third conflict took place after the nuclear test in 1998. And many people say because China hates India to possess nuclear weapon. That's not true. Because India is a bigger power. India possesses a nuclear weapon. That is India's own option. And you want to do it, you have to be ready to pay the price, right? And it's nothing to do with China. The trouble is the India Prime Minister, Vajpayee, wrote a letter to President Clinton. And the Clinton administration revealed the letter to the New York Times, in which the India Prime Minister used China as an excuse to develop its nuclear weapon program. So that offended China enormously. And that also, in my opinion, gave India a lesson how to deal with the Americans. Anyway, and this conflict lasted quite short, actually. And the third round of rapprochement started in 2003, when Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee paid a very, very important visit to China. And during that visit, basically the two sides did three things. One is India, for the first time, by a written form in an official document, declared that Tibetan, the autonomous region of Tibet, is a part of the People's Republic of China. That is, by its root, by its nature, solve the problem between, very, very important problem between China and India. And the second thing, both sides signed a memorandum of understanding in terms of Sino-India trade agreement by reopening the Nathula Pass. And the Nathula Pass through Sikkim into India prop. That memorandum actually solved the problem that China actually recognizes, acknowledges that Sikkim is part of India. You may see, you may argue that this is a trade-off or whatever, but this is the real thing. And India insisted that China should make a public statement by this, but China refused. Instead, China insisted on this kind of a memorandum signature in order to solve this Sikkim problem. So which way is more smart? What kind of wisdom, of the Asian wisdom, to solve our dispute? This is a typical case. When Vajpayee back to New Delhi, there was a lot of debates among the Indians themselves, whether it is rational and whether India has won or not. But basically, we say the two countries solved the fundamental issues. The third thing they have to do, both sides did, was the signature of our building up special representative mechanism for talks and the dialogue in order to settle down the boundary issues. That is, from a political perspective, the Chinese send their very important representative, Mr. Dai Bingguo, who is now the state councillor and who has a direct channel to Hu Jintao. And India's special representative envoy is National Security Advisor, Mr. Narayana, who also has a direct channel to the prime minister. So this is a very important mechanism for both sides trying to solve their long-lasting boundary issue. And so the current status of Sino-India relationship is what? People may argue, because having said this, all these kind of efforts, all these kind of things, and what are you now? Why in the Indian media always there are sort of stories describing very negative things about China, and what about the Chinese media? And basically, I would say, I would give you a picture that in April 2005, the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao visited India. During that visit, two sides declared a building up of a strategic partnership for peace and prosperity. This is, you may say this is rhetoric, but this is also a real thing, because it's not easy for China or for India to agree at this particular point that the two countries should become a strategic partnership for peace and prosperity. And now in three levels, in three areas, that bilateral relationship have been developing very fast. In terms of economic exchanges, cooperation, trade, the two sides have seen or witnessed a dramatic jump of, say, bilateral trade on an annual growth rate of more than 50%. Some years, even 70% or 80%. Last year, the two bilateral trade volume was $38 billion. And this year, from January to July, only 7 months already break through $40 billion. So definitely, China will become the largest trading partner to India and would surpass that of the United States. I think there is no doubt about this. And in a political level, I think mutual suspicions have been reduced, I would say. And in the year 2006, the Chinese President Hu Jintao visited New Delhi. Again, the two sides decided to push ahead in 10 areas. Imagine, 10 areas, including all kinds of things, people-to-people exchanges, water resources, all kinds, and also boundary issues. And the 10 strategic moves is very important for the two countries in terms of their political development. And in the security and the military area, many people say, oh, India have very deep suspicions and vice versa. The Chinese don't trust India. And therefore, the two countries in the security and the military area, nothing can be talked. No, it's not true. I tell you that between China and India, three rounds of naval joint exercises have been conducted, starting from 2003. And one is in China, or two were in the Chinese territory and one in India. And the last year, in the end of the year, the Chinese and Indian army conducted a joint exercises counter-terror campaign in the Yunnan province. That was the first time for the ground troops for the two sides conduct joint exercises. And India, on India's side, suggestion was already made to conduct joint exercises of the two air forces sometime next year. And which means that even in this very sensitive area, the two sides are developing their bilateral relationship at a very accelerating pace. So what is the major problems? Having said all these positive sides, you say, well, China, India, nothing negative. No, of course, it's not true. There are negative sides, and also very, very important problems are still existing between the two sides. Basically, generally, very briefly, I would touch upon three old issues are still existing. One is Tibet. Despite the fact that India declares Tibet is part of China. We know that, of course, Dalai Lama and his followers and also as many as 100,000, you know, more than 100,000 Tibetans in exile are still living in India, and it is still a problem between China and India, Tibet. That's the old problem. And second old problem is, of course, border dispute, despite the fact that we have established, built up a very useful, very functional mechanism, the problem itself has not yet been solved. And the third one, old problem, is Pakistan. And India still perceive China or perceive Pakistan as a kind of a card played by China as a counterweight against India. That is the old perception and is still there. And because I don't have time to elaborate this issue, this is a three old problem. What about a new problem? Because the two countries are developing so fast and becoming so called one of the major economic powers in today's world. And what happened between them, between the two, in terms of new problems, in addition to those old problems? I think there are also three new problems. One is how to participate in the regional integration process. India's participation in Asia-Pacific and the Chinese participation in South Asia, both of them come across obstacles. When Chinese try to participate in South Asia regional progress, the process, India set up a lot of obstacles, and vice versa. India perceives China's move, China's behavior in Asia-Pacific, in East Asia, as a kind of obstacle to block India's progress. This is one new problem. And second new problem is the disparity between the two countries in terms of their national power and their respective status and positions in the world system. China is a permanent member of Security Council in the United Nations, and China's GDP, totality is roughly about three times that of India. And this disparity is still being enlarged because the Chinese development pace is faster than India. And India's population growth is much faster than that of China. So that makes the disparity between the two countries even larger in the years to come. And that makes it very difficult for India to recognize China as a partner in the international system. Rather, India would see China as some kind of target. India should catch up with. India should exceed that of China. And that makes the two countries sometimes a little bit difficult to deal with each other. And certainly, in the international system, despite the fact that the two countries share a lot of common grounds, the real situation makes both sides sometimes very difficult to stand together, like the reform of the United Nations and the WTO, and also in other areas like like IMF or like World Bank. You know, all these international regime in this level, the two countries have a lot of differences. So the conclusion is, I can argue that the major issue, the most important problem for China and India, is the lack of sufficient mutual trust. How to address this trust problem? There are lots of debates among the Chinese scholars and officials alike. I can tell you that Beijing government is determined to push ahead this bilateral relationship. And the Chinese government already realized the very important significance of India as China's neighbor, as an Asian giant, as a fast-developing economy, etc., etc. But how to deal with India? It is still a very important challenge to the Chinese decision-making. Shall we pay more attention, make more efforts in improving our mutual trust, and then we try to solve long-lasting problems such as the boundary issue, or vice versa? We should overcome all these existing old problems in the first place, and in that process, mutual trust could be built up gradually, step by step. A lot of debates. We don't have a conclusion, to tell you the truth. We don't have a conclusion. How to deal with India remains as a very important challenge. And by the same token, I can safely predict that in New Delhi, this is also a very serious challenge for India's decision makers, how to deal with China. Because China fasts even faster China's power is increasing at a dramatic pace, and India is also full of a preventive mentality, etc., etc. And so, in this at this point, finally, I would argue that I think the concept of Chindia is, in this sense, in this context, is quite helpful in terms of redefine Sino-India relationship. This is on the bilateral sense. I think this is not a zero-sum game. And to explore the real meaning and the implication of Chindia would help the decision makers in the two capitals to realize the real situation and the real life of today's world, what the two developing countries are facing, and what we, or in what way we should deal with the United States or other things. Because time is too fast. Could I have time? I just stop here. Okay. Finally, I would say a little things about Chindia and its relationship with the international system. And the first point I want to make is stability of international system benefits developing powers like China and India. And without stability of the system, the development program, the pace, the growth of developing countries like China and India are not possible. That's the first point I want to make. Secondly, today's world is dominated by the United States, creating a very unique equilibrium. And in some sense, we can argue this kind of equilibrium or balance is abnormal, with the United States as having its absolute power in a pyramid, you know, pyramid-like system on the top, and all other countries are just below. And the U.S. strategy is to prevent any possible candidates to challenge this kind of abnormal structure. And because the United States perceives this system as rational, as reasonable, should be sustainable and forever, United States should take the leadership forever. So this kind of things, you know, in terms of China, India, and the United States dominance and supremacy is in conflict, actually. But the development, the change of the power of both China and India are irreversible, and that is one of the reasons why, starting from the Bush administration, the first term, United States classified both China and India into the category of developing power at the strategic crossroad, right? And, of course, this category also includes Russia, but not including like Japan or Germany or other bigger powers, because they don't have the intention or independent foreign policy or the desire to change the international system. But the United States are quite uncertain about the behavior and thinking and the strategic planning of either China or India in the future. And the third point I want to make is China and India as a developing power, of course, certainly they want to have more to say in the international system, and they want to have a more important position in the international regime. And therefore, the two countries are very much dissatisfied with the status quo of the international system, and they hope by some way, in some sense, to some directions, we can change that international system. And but what kind of change China really or India really pursues, no one knows. It isn't clear. We just want to change. That's all. But the United States, what the United States is worried about is that kind of intention. You want to change it, therefore you are uncertain and a potential challenger. And so this, and for both China and India, we have no idea how to change the system. And even we do not know how to deal with the system, but we have to live with that system dominated by the United States. That's the third point I want to make. And the fourth point, because of historical, bilateral, and your geopolitical, realistic reasons and factors, China and India, as a matter of fact, do not share much in common in terms of their respective views towards the international system. Therefore, for the United States, Chindia is not yet a combined force, and the United States hopes that it will not be in the combined force in the future. And that's why when President Bush visited New Delhi in March 2006, the president declared that the United States would like to help India become a global power. But what kind of global power the United States hopes to see India become? The president never gives an definition, nor does Secretary Rice. But in Washington, D.C., this is only kind of a strategic vision. Perhaps the rise up of India would help balance the rise up of China. This is a quite vague thinking, strategic vision in Washington, D.C., and on that basis, United States has adjusted its policy towards India, leading to a very important consequence. That is the nuclear deal to release the isolation of India over the last 3 decades. And the United States believes that perhaps China and India cannot challenge the international system. But that actually covers an even more important reason. That leads to my last point. That is, my argument is neither China nor India really want to challenge the international system. But the major reason is not China and India balance against each other. That's not the major reason. The major reason is in the foreseeable future, their development cannot be separate from the stability of the international system, which has been guaranteed and maintained by the United States. That is the basic fundamental reason the two countries, developing powers in Asia, in the foreseeable future, are not going to challenge the dominance of the United States. Not because the challenge itself is politically incorrect or morally incorrect, but because we have the basic, more important needs of economic growth, which cannot be separated from the stability of the international system. Thank you very much for your patience.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Zhao. You put a lot of very interesting ideas and issues on the table, and we will next turn to Ambassador Schaefer for her comments, and then we'll have some question and discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Zhao. And I am going to make you happy because I am going to fit into the category in which you placed U.S. thinking, at least up to a certain point. It is true, I do not see Chindia as one force, but as two. I'd like to talk a little bit about the rise of India, the rise of China, as separate phenomena taking place at the same time. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about how I think this impacts on the United States. And I will come around at the end to the points you were making about the international system, which I found particularly interesting. I think there are two large elements to the rise of China and the rise of India. The first is economic, and China started well before India did. Extraordinary record of growth, not only in the Chinese economy, but also in its interaction with the rest of the world, and in the growth of certain key industries, which are likely to be important not just for China, but also for the development of the global economy. In the Indian case, the period of faster growth actually started earlier than a lot of people recognize. It started in about 1980. But it first achieved international prominence in the mid-1990s when the so-called Asian tigers, particularly in Southeast Asia and even in Korea, stumbled. India was, to a large extent, insulated from that crisis and therefore, as India maintained its growth rate, it suddenly started looking like one of the fastest growing economies in the world. India, too, has increased its interaction with the world, but that which is a dramatic change for India looks small in comparison with what's happening with China. On the one hand, the percentage of trade in India's gross domestic product has more than doubled. On the other hand, India's trade with the United States, just to take one example, is about 1/9 of China's. So, on the one hand and on the other hand. But there is no question that economic growth is an important element in the greater international power and prominence of both countries. And it is being seen that way. I defer to Professor Zhao about how China sees it, but I can tell you that in the case of India, my favorite example is a book that was published by a friend of mine, Sanjay Baru, who was until recently the spokesman for the prime minister, but before that was an economic journalist. The book was about economic power as an element in national power, and he had definitely converted to that point of view. But I remember a meeting in which we both participated in about 2002, in which he referred to the strategic importance to India of being considered a developing country. So this represents a considerable shift in the way this person looked at the world, and I think that's reasonably representative. Second element in India's and China's rise, military, massive defense budget increases in both places. Again, China got started earlier. But what's particularly interesting about the Indian example is that the lion's share of the procurement money, the purchasing money, has gone to the Navy and the Air Force, which have always been very much the junior services on the Indian scene. The other interesting thing is that India has underspent its budget every year. I don't know whether this means that the budget should be interpreted, you know, the last 5% of the budget should be interpreted as political statement, or whether it simply reflects the difficulty of pushing that much money out the door and getting value for it, but I find it interesting. The Navy and the Air Force are significant because not only are they at least in principle instruments of power projection, but in the case of the Navy, this is the service whose main responsibility lies in protecting the energy sea lines. So this gets you back to the idea of an economically driven foreign policy, an economically driven vision of national power. You have a couple of future issues that I think will be important. One is energy, where India and China, I think, primarily see themselves as rivals, even though the word cooperation is spoken a great deal. The other is climate change, on which India and China have basically the same view, that this is a vitally important question that you, the United States, need to deal with. I think in the future we're all going to have to come around to a different point of view. The U.S. will have to be less cynical about the issue, and India and China, I think, once that happens, may have a little bit easier time getting themselves into the posture of reducing emissions. As I said, I see these as separate phenomena, but I don't think we have a choice to make between the pessimistic view that says India and China are rivals and the optimistic view that says they are bhai-bhai, they will cooperate, because I think those two tendencies will coexist. Mm-hmm. They do now. The Indian Foreign Secretary gave a speech here about 3 or 4 years ago. This is a man who had been India's number two diplomat in the embassy in Beijing. And he was asked a question about this. This fellow was a little bit blunter than some of his predecessors in that job had been. His answer was, there will be elements of conflict and elements of cooperation, and that's just the way it's going to be. I think this was a very correct assessment. Then you come to the impact on the United States, and I would deal with this under three headings. One is, where does Asia fit in U.S. policy? The second is economic, and the third is international institutions. The where does Asia fit question is interesting because it's very clear to me, and it's also very clear in polling that's been done over the past several years in the U.S. public, that Asia is much closer to the center of U.S. foreign policy than it was in the days when our post-World War II policy was being shaped and the post-World War II system was being created. But there are important questions in Asia. There are far more than I'm going to give you now, but I'd like to focus on three, where the respective roles of India and China and the way the United States deals with both of them are particularly important. The first is the question of the distribution of power in Asia, or the balance of power. I actually like the phrase balance of power, but I'm a minority of one in that regard, so I suppose you'll start throwing tomatoes at me or something. The U.S. vision for Asia doesn't involve having Asia dominated by one single power. That means that the logic of China's increased power is that the U.S. will set increasing importance on having big relationships with the other big Asian countries. Japan was always there. India is now part of that group. We haven't really looked at Russia in the Asia context, but that day may come too. The second question, which is very much related to that, is what is going to be the Indian role in Asia, and by Asia in this case, I mean basically everything from approximately Pakistan on east. In other words, I'm not drawing an invisible barrier between South and East Asia. I think India has been paying much more attention to its neighbors to the east. China always got a lot of attention. I'm talking about Southeast Asia. I'm talking about Japan. I'm talking about Korea. I think this is something the U.S. welcomes. But for a variety of reasons, including the way the U.S. government is bureaucratically organized, the U.S. has not been particularly eager to encourage India's greater involvement in the East Asia-based regional institutions. I think this is something that may change, too. I'm fascinated by Professor Zhao's comments on India's integration in East Asia, China's integration in South Asia. It had been my impression that the Chinese government did not want to have India included in the East Asian summit. It was, in fact, included. That organization so far is not winning any prizes for dynamism. But these are the institutional development of Asia, I think, is not going to look like Europe. And you may find that different organizations acquire their own role in different parts of Asia's regional life. And the final question on the importance of Asia in the world is what is to be the U.S. role? The vision from Washington has always been that the U.S. is an Asian power. It certainly is a Pacific power. It's always had a very important role in Asia. Today, I think that's something China and India are comfortable with. Will they still be comfortable with it? Will they have different views on it 20 years from now? I think we'll have to have another conversation later. And there are lots of things that will happen in the meantime that may influence that. My guess would be that China will be less comfortable with it. And I frankly don't know what the answer will be on India, because the India-U.S. partnership is at such an early stage that it could go in a lot of different directions. Second point, economically, and this we can deal with very quickly, India and China, as we said, are growing economically. They are going to have a larger trade profile in the world. China, obviously, much larger than India for the time being, although the disparity there may, in fact, start to shrink. In one sense, I suppose this could be considered to be happening at the expense of the U.S., because the U.S. is the world's largest economy. I don't worry about that at all. But I do believe that the importance of China and Asia in global prosperity is going to increase. And if the U.S. is facing financial troubles that we all know about, and the possibility that these will become economic troubles, there is an interdependence that's going to work both ways. This is relatively new for China. This is very new for India. Third point, international institutions. Now, this is a really interesting one. Professor Zhao wound up by commenting that India and China aren't going to challenge the international system, not because of some kind of moral argument, but because they both depend on it and on its stability for their own future development. I think that there's a lot of truth in that. And yet both India and China, in slightly different ways, mm-hmm. are revisionist powers when it comes to the international mm-hmm. system. China only recently entered the World Trade Organization. China mm-hmm. and India are both regular guests, but not members of the G8. Neither is a member of the OECD. Neither, as a result, is a member of the International Energy Agency, which is truly nutty, since that's supposed to be a consumer organization, and these are the two biggest consumers, or at least the two fastest growing. India would like to have a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. I have to assume that China is not keen on that. I would say that the United States is polite about that, but is frankly not interested in lifting a finger to change the composition of the Security Council, because any change is bound to make it bigger and more unwieldy. Mm-hmm. It's not against anybody in particular, but I think that's where we are. I think both India and China, in different ways and with somewhat different strengths and weaknesses, are going to be looking for a bigger role in the global institutions. Mm-hmm. And they are going to achieve that bigger role. The real question is with how much disruption mm-hmm. and with what kind of showdowns at the background. To give you one example, an institution we haven't talked about, which is the World Bank, I would bet money that there are senior economic officials in both the Indian and the Chinese governments who think they would be dandy presidents of the World Bank. We just had a showdown over the World Bank last winter. It was obvious that in order to solve the problems that had arisen with one particular American leader, the only move to make was to insert another American leader, so that you were only tackling one issue at a time. But I think the whole way that those institutions are structured and managed, and also the quota system. Of course, changing the quota system means putting more money in so that there are downsides to that. Expect this to be an interesting stage in the future. Expect India and China to be making a bid for a greater role at the same time, not necessarily in harmony.
Well, thank you so much. So many interesting issues to talk about. I'd like to make a brief comment and then perhaps pose a question to both of you, and then we'll open up the floor. Professor Zhao, you started out by saying that Sino-Indian relations are not really very important to the United States, that people here don't follow them that closely. And I suppose, although it might not be the highest on our list of priorities, I would venture to say that this is a relationship that is important to the United States, and particularly in terms of how the two countries manage their differences. China has successfully solved its border disputes with, and particularly land border disputes, with almost all of its neighbors. Yeah. So India really stands out, with perhaps the Koreas being a small issue in the future as well. But India really stands out as being that one outstanding area where there are remaining border disputes. And, of course, these are two countries that have nuclear weapons. So having ensuring that these differences are settled peacefully through negotiations, I think that the U.S. has a very strong interest in that, and certainly not seeing tensions flare up between the two countries as they have done in the past. So let me just pose one question to each of you. For Professor Zhao, you stated that strategic suspicions between India and China have been reduced, and so I guess I'd like to ask you to elaborate on that, and why you think they have been reduced, and what areas have progress been made, and in what area, not specifically in terms of border, but why do you see the overall strategic suspicions as having been reduced, and is that perhaps contrary to your statement that the biggest problem between the two countries is the need to build strategic mutual trust. So how do you balance those two? And for Ambassador Schaefer, I wonder if you could comment on how important you think the China factor is in the U.S.-India relationship and in U.S. policy toward India.
Well, I think that over the last couple of years, especially since Mr. Vajpayee's visit to Beijing in 2003, the two countries have been making enormous efforts in overcoming this kind of strategic suspicions by building up a lot of substantial measures, including, increasing the people-to-people exchanges, such as, for instance, before the year 2003, there was only one flight between China and India, direct flight on a weekly basis. That is, was run by China Eastern Airlines. And today, on a daily basis, we've got a number of flights between China and India. Much more exchanges have been increasing dramatically. So this is obviously one of the results from the efforts by the two governments. And this, I think the purpose is to reduce that kind of suspicions. I traveled to India many, many times, and I have a lot of chance to talk to India's business communities. And today I can quite safely say that among the India's business community, China's development, China's growth, and the Chinese economy is perceived much, much more as a very important opportunity rather than a threat or challenge to India's business operation. And today we have more and more Indians settling down in Shanghai, purchase house, and working for the Chinese companies as well as for the Western transnationals, because Indians enjoy English-speaking advantages while most Chinese cannot speak good English. So this kind of things reflecting a very important side of the bilateral relationship. Of course, I cannot deny the fact that in the Indian media and in the decision-making level, there are still hardliners and people who have tough opinions about the so-called the Chinese desire or Chinese intention. But I'm quite I want to say that that's not the mainstream as far as the current status of the Sino-India relations is concerned.
How important is China in India-U.S. relations? Let me start with what it is not. I don't think that the U.S. interest in a strategic partnership with India is an effort to line up some kind of an anti-China group. I don't think the U.S. is playing that game, and I am very confident that India would not be interested on that basis. But there is a connection, and that connection runs through what I said before about what Asia is going to look like down the road. And if China's relative power in Asia is increasing, it becomes more important for the United States to have significant strategic relations with all of the large powers in Asia. We certainly have one with China, but also with Japan, which we already do, with Korea, with India. And I think that's the way that these two relationships are relevant.
Okay, we'll take questions from the floor. In the back?
Yes.
We have a microphone.
Thank you, Tim Bennett. I think the professor touched a little bit upon this in his response, but how much of the current rapprochement between the two countries is driven by business interests, by the private sector? The increase in foreign investment, primarily in the tech sector in both China and India, primarily by the multinationals, a lot of transfer of personnel, a lot of division of labor, certain parts of software development happening in India, more of the hardware assembly in China, the transfer of personnel, the recognition of the opportunities, the tremendous opportunities for both countries, job creation, wealth creation. So to what extent has that private sector initiatives and exchanges, which are occurring regardless of what's going on issues such as Tibet or the Dalai Lama and all that, how much has that driven government attitudes?
Obviously, the private sectors play a very important role in increasing the mutual investment and people-to-people exchanges between the two countries. This is partially, as I just argued, that is partially a very important reflection of the rapprochement effort by the two governments. Without the governmental effort, you know, the environment for investment would be worse than it is now. And for instance, in India, the Chinese investment in the past would be held with a very kind of sort of suspicions. And the Indians use a kind of variety of reasons in terms of, say, national security, etc., in order to block the Chinese investment. And all these things are improving in over the last couple of years. And today, the Chinese IT investors have a huge investment in India, and they have very actively participated in the international bidding and defeating, I think, a number of famous brands like Nokia and other, you know, in very famous international companies. And I think the Chinese participation in India's economic activities is expected to increase over the years to come. And vice versa, the same thing, and investment from India in China mostly are from the private sectors. That's why I argue that the business communities mostly welcome the rapprochement efforts by the two governments, and they don't believe that the Dalai Lama or the unsettled boundary issue should be an issue to prevent the two countries from developing their normal state-to-state relationship. I think this argument was raised by the Chinese President Jiang Zemin when he visited New Delhi in 1996. But he made this statement, a very important argument, not in New Delhi, but in Islamabad. That's very interesting. He visited the two countries. In India, he said nothing. He would say, okay, everything is good, China, India. And then he went to Islamabad. In the Pakistani parliament, he made a very important point that even if we had problems unsettled, unresolved, it should never prevent development of a normal state-to-state relationship. This argument won high appreciation among the Indians, I believe.
Let me complicate that picture a little bit. I agree with what the professor said, although I would note that the Indian government still appears in practice to be restricting Chinese investments in infrastructure areas. But if you look at the trade, you actually get a slightly different picture, and I think these can both be true at the same time. China is India's largest partner for goods trade. You put services in, the U.S. is way ahead. But Chinese exports to India are diverse and include a lot of manufacturers and machinery. India's exports to China are almost entirely raw materials, ores, slag and ash, cotton. Much of this is actually traded by public sector corporations or by the state. When Chinese and Indian government officials get together and say, we plan to double, triple, whatever our trade over the next X years, they are actually in a position to make that happen in a way that they would not be if it were American officials, because we don't control our trade to the same extent. So that, and the fact that India's exports to China are so heavily raw materials has not escaped the notice of the Indian business community. So that while there's enthusiasm about the investment opportunities, there is some degree of concern about whether China ultimately is going to be an open market for the kinds of things that they can actually produce.
Patrick Norton. Following up on the raw materials issue, in a broader sense, having access to raw materials is a major strategic concern for both of these countries with rapidly growing economies. China in particular has been very aggressive in trying to lock up long-term supplies worldwide for a broad range of materials. And competition for these kinds of materials can have geopolitical implications as well as economic implications. I wonder if you'd comment on the potential rivalry of the two economies for those kinds of resources.
The area I know best has to do with energy and specifically with oil. There are two different ways to ensure your energy security. One is to lock up the production chain, at least to certain assets, and try to make sure that that production is dedicated to you or would be if in a crisis. China has played that game more effectively than India has. They have used the word cooperation a lot, but they have not hesitated to knife each other if that seemed to be the most convenient thing. And my favorite example of that was an Indian investment in Burma, which turned out not to be enough of a security device to prevent the Burmese from dedicating exports from that field to China. The other way to look at energy security is through the market. And the interesting thing in India's case is that at the top level, this is the official view of the government, but it's not actually the way their policy seems to work in practice. I think that there is lots of opportunity for cooperation, but not in the deal-making business. I see essentially no possibility that Indian and Chinese energy officials will go in on deals together, except in the most unusual circumstances. They've got one thing going in Syria, but this is very small potatoes. The real question is whether the way the world is going to encourage the market view or the mercantilistic view. In recent years, the mercantilistic view has actually not been very effective. I hope that the Wall Street meltdown doesn't encourage a generally more inward-looking view of economic developments.
Well, in bilateral sense, of course, China is the largest importer of India-produced iron ore. You know, that is a major category of the Chinese imports from India, and some India people are dissatisfied with this factor. They say India is not an African country. India is not a country purely export its raw material to China. But yet, China, the fact is China is the number one largest producer of iron and steel and iron in today's world. Therefore, naturally, China has to import a lot of ores and iron ores. And India produces a lot of iron ores. If you do not want to sell to the Chinese, who else do you want to sell? That's a problem. And so this is also very important business opportunities in Mumbai and in Calcutta and other big ports. I think this should be a mutual beneficial relationship. And in the meantime, China is not going to exploit this situation by doing something in order to hurt the interests of India, and this is a world market, and we follow the rule of the markets. In terms of energy, I think I acknowledge there is a very sharp competition between China and India because both of the two countries are newcomers, and the world oil market basically is dominated by the Western powers. What about for the newcomers? And so the newcomers have to go to other places like Angola, like Botswana, like, you know, Latin American countries. And those countries who are, you know, hostile against the United States, like Venezuela, and then, you know, either China or India would take the chance to go there. And but basically, I think the Chinese and the Indians, if there is any opportunity to cooperate in the raw material market, I think that the two sides would do it because it would be mutually beneficial. But if there is no opportunity and there is only option for competition, then either Chinese companies or Indian companies have no other options. That is what's going on in Angola.
Thank you. Surjit Man Singh, American University. Professor Chow, I'd like to go back to the points you made about the so-called package deal first offered by Premier Chow in 1960, then to the best of my knowledge, offered again by Deng Xiaoping in 1981-82. I did not see any reference to it in the Rajiv Gandhi Deng meeting, but going back to the early 80s, one has to concede that Mrs. Gandhi's government did not immediately take it up. there was some two-year delay in taking it up after considering it very, very carefully. But as far as I know, when the government of India did take up Deng Xiaoping's proposal for a package deal, which had not been carefully defined, it was assumed to be the same as Premier Chow's offer in 1960, the Chinese government rapidly backtracked. And therefore, that is why it collapsed in the 1980s. I wonder if you have better sources and can elucidate that incident.
Well, I do not have declassified official documents in this regard. I'm sorry. But yet I can argue that because I had talks with Ambassador Ranganathan, who was the diplomat in 1979 when Foreign Minister Vajpayee had talks with Deng Xiaoping, when Deng Xiaoping offered the package deal. You are right, Deng Xiaoping, this deal was not raised in 1988 talks, but in 1979, but it was turned down. And this visit by Vajpayee was not seen, at least by the Indians, as a success. Because when Vajpayee left Beijing and when he was in Hangzhou, the Chinese war against Vietnam broke out, and then Vajpayee was very angry and was very, very upset. The Chinese are going to teach others lessons again, or that kind of thing. Anyway, I think this package deal, when Deng Xiaoping offered in 1979, implied a lot of things. I asked the Indian ambassador, I say, whether Deng Xiaoping really detailed the package deal, the real contents, whether India, China would give up the eastern sector, the so-called Arunachal Pradesh, and India would give up its claims in the western sector, that's Aksai Ching. And the ambassador said, no. Deng Xiaoping never said it. Deng Xiaoping said the package deal, and then Vajpayee did not respond. Then Deng Xiaoping kept silent. So they believe, it is believed, that India lost a chance, opportunity. If Mr. Vajpayee had taken these proposals by responding to Deng Xiaoping, then more detailed discussion would be conducted. And I think by that time, Deng Xiaoping was the most important, the very, very powerful man, and he can do this. And what about the successors? Why Deng Xiaoping did not say that anymore after that? I think this offer, this Chinese compromise, caused very heated debates among the Chinese themselves. I believe so. Because there is no reason why China should give up 90,000 square kilometers, only keeping 38,000 square kilometers. This is not an equal and fair trade-off from many Chinese perceptions, I think. This is the major reasons, perhaps, but I don't have declassified official documents to prove that. I'm sorry.
Thank you. My name is Shi Zhongliu from Brookings. I think in addition to the question of whether this notion of Chindia will be converged in the near future. Another question is also about how fast will India catch up with China in terms of economic development. And you didn't talk a little bit more about how each country deal with its own domestic challenges. You talk a lot about the bilateral challenge and those political and economic hurdles that both sides need to remove. My understanding, and I'm sure that most people in this room agree with that, that there are, each side has problems. And India, this lack of administrative efficiency and infrastructure, and also this so-called red tape cultures. And in China, there are also problems associated with environmental protection and other demographic problems resulted from this one-child policies, which makes India in this field, it's got more like a younger and more energetic workforce. So I was just wondering what's your take on that. I mean, in terms of some predict that China's going to experience a relatively economic slowdown by the year of 2015. The annual growth rate might be dropped to 7% or maybe 6%. But in India, some say that by the year of 2020, still able to maintain at least 8% annual growth rate. So you mentioned earlier, you know, that India is falling behind to China by at least 10 to 15 years. I was just wondering if you want to make a prediction in terms of how each side deal with its own domestic problems, and to what extent will India catch up with China, or maybe it will not? Thank you.
Actually, this debate began in early 1990s when India launched its economic reform, and people argue that India enjoyed a lot of comparative advantages, such as the relatively perfect judiciary system and competitive environment for business, etc., which China does not have. And so after 17 years, the reality proves something different. On an annual basis, even India implemented its economic reform and open door policy and tried to participate in the world economic process and the regional integrations. On an annual basis, estimate or all the statistics show that India's development pace has been far behind that of China. India's average annual growth rate is in this period, 17 or 18 years, roughly about 6% or 6.5%, and China is two digits growth rate. Okay, that's one thing. Second thing, whether the Chinese domestic problem would prevent the nation from developing further, even fell down, well, this is a lot of there are a lot of estimates in this regard, and whether Chinese would launch a kind of new political reform in order to catch up with this kind of economic development, economic environment. So this is a very debatable issue, and the Chinese call it a kind of how do you say? It's a progressive improvement. We call it in the political arena. The Chinese are thinking of all the necessary reform, the steps. In the meantime, of course, the Chinese professionals who are working on India look at India very carefully. For instance, in 2004, in April to May, there was a general election in India, right? Elected a very important election. And the Chinese media and all kinds of organizations, think tanks, send hundreds of professionals to go to India to have an on-the-spot observation of the democracy, how to conduct a democracy in such a poor, low level of development countries. And a lot of reports and stories back into China, and the readers and the Chinese audience were shocked to understand, to perceive how smoothly the India democratic progress has been developing. So I think these all kinds of things are very important lessons. I hope the Chinese are very good at learning all these things and try to tackle our own problems. But yet, you are right, perhaps in the future, in next 30 years, 20 years, a lot of predictions, perhaps India would be faster than China and finally exceeds that of China in terms of economic totality. It is possible. But over the last two decades, we do not see it. And what about in the next two decades? I'm not sure. But one thing I want to assure you that Chinese and Indians' economic development is not a zero-sum game, a kind of match. One wins, the other is defeated. It doesn't exist. This kind of rhetoric is nonsense. If India wins, India becomes a more important developing power. That is not a disaster to China. I believe so. And I believe that India, you're right, India also has its own problems to address. And India's democracy has proved that decision-making level in all the levels, I would say, is very, very not efficient, very, very slow. That is why, over the last two decades, while China built up 50,000 expressway highways, world-class highways, India has nothing. Over the last two decades, they have nothing to build up. Because of what? Because of the slow pace of decision-making level. So I think this is something our Indian friends should think of it.
I have four people left on the list, so I think what I'm going to do is collect all four questions, and if you please identify yourself before you make your question, I'd appreciate it, and then we'll turn back to the panelists so that they can respond to them. Beginning in the back over here.
Thank you. I'm Rajesh Kadian. A quick question. Both countries have faced Islamic fundamentalism. Is there some cooperation there? Same thing about narcotic smuggling.
Yes, Professor Jha, you had identified Pakistan as one of the three major problems. How would it impact, in your judgment, the Pakistani factor with the current happenings on the Afghan-Pakistan frontier and the unrest now taking place in Kashmir?
Hi, this is a follow-up to an earlier question about Sino-Indian energy rivalries. In 2005, there was an Indian and Chinese companies bidding for an Angolan oil block, and a Chinese Exim Bank loan package was said to have tipped the balance in Sinopec's favor. How did India respond to that? And in general, how has China's energy strategy affected India's energy acquisition strategy in Africa?
Ernie Prieg, Manufacturers Alliance, which is a private sector think tank here in town. I can say all our 500 members are very interested in both China and India. They're very much into Chindi. In fact, so much so that a couple of years ago, I'm the international staff person. They did greatly urge me to do a book length, actually, on India and China, which came out earlier this year and is entitled India and China, an Advanced Technology Race and How the United States Should Respond. And in fact, it was jointly published by CSIS with a great deal of input from the other people here, and Ambassador Schaefer has a commentary with a broader perspective on India at the end. So you may want to look into it, because an advanced technology race has the sense of some rivalry, and certainly the last 3 or 4 years I come out that there is a closing of the gap, just one very brief comment, in terms of multinational companies and outbound investment. India in the last 2 or 3 years, the private companies are moving ahead of China in a number of key sectors, not only engineering and software, financial services, but pharmaceuticals, steel, and perhaps automotive. So there's a lot in the book you may find of interest. But I had two specific questions. Not quite so much economic from your comments that I would appreciate your reaction. The first is the build-up, the military, which is in both countries, the advanced technology industry and military modernization overlap. But in India, which is, as Tezi mentioned earlier, it's been moving ahead rapidly, particularly in the Air Force and the Navy, and also the space, the missile program and outer space. And it's not just energy and economics, but I believe it's a lot of comments, and they're in the book, some of them. It has to do with what the Chinese modernization, and because the army was traditionally Pakistan, and then the Navy, Air Force, satellites, outer space with the space weapon. There's just so many comments by the Indians that I've come across saying we have to keep up with the rapid pace in China. So are there any discussions that you have in an arms race here that's something that certainly needs to be addressed, I would think. And the final question is, you said before there really wasn't any definition between the U.S. and India when we get together about our places in the world, but we almost always start by saying we're the two largest democracies. We share the values of rule of law, individual rights, free and open elections. I would hope, and I have a lot of recommendations on how you could join us, China, with your own characteristics if you like, but if all three of us were democracies, it would be a much better world. But right now, it's not that way. And don't you see this as a significant factor from the Chinese point of view of how India and the U.S. do define, in a central way, our role in international affairs?
First, about Islamic terror extremists. I'm not going to call it Islamic terrorists. Some kind of extremists, and whether China and India have a cooperation. Yes, we have a mechanism, actually, and we built up this mechanism in 2004, I think. And this is a mechanism against Islamic extremists and also religious extremists. But unfortunately, due to many reasons, I think this mechanism, it seems to me, doesn't work. Doesn't work. We have like one or two meetings either in New Delhi or in Beijing, and then nothing happens. And then I think we move to the year of 2005, China and India conducted the first round of strategic dialogue in the foreign ministry level, and I think this is a very important progress in terms of the bilateral relationship in many areas, including the anti-terror campaign and this area. I think you are right that China suffered a lot from this kind of potential or realistic terrorist movement led by the Eastern Turkish movement. And also India has been actually the victims of many terrorist attacks. And in this area, I believe China and India can develop a lot of potential in terms of military-to-military cooperation, as well as in security force-to-security force cooperation. I hope this would be a new area. Actually, last year, we conducted the first troop joint exercises in Kunming, the southern city of China. The aim is anti-terror training and prevention. And I think this would be a new area to explore in the future. And secondly, about Pakistan and also the Kashmir and the Chinese, I think this is precisely the area for three parties, actually: China, India, and Pakistan. And of course, Pakistan basically is an Indian problem. It's not a Chinese problem. But yet, many Indians believe or perceive the Chinese involvement or Chinese engagement with India would become or could become a kind of threat to India's national security. But that was the past. And today, I think India's perception in this area has been improving or has been changing, adjusting. And they believe that if China and India, the bilateral relationship, can improve at a normal, steady way, then Pakistan would no longer be a problem. On the contrary, in other words, we may argue that in the context of improved relationship between China and India, Pakistan actually could become an opportunity for further cooperation between the two countries. I think the three countries share a lot of common grounds, actually. And China wants to see stability and peace, and India too. And what about Pakistan? Pakistan faces major problems, internal problems, right? Mainly is internal. But if Pakistan could have a favorable and very good environment, external environment, it would be very helpful in terms of solving its own domestic internal problems. And in this regard, we may argue that both China and India are very important external variable to Pakistan. And I think China would help Pakistan as well as to cooperate with India to counterattack these all kinds of terrorist activities in order to keep peaceful stability. And thirdly, about energy, you are right. China and India did have have had a number of kinds of sorts of competition, even conflict in Africa because of energy and how to solve the problem. And India sent its oil minister, petrol minister, to Beijing in 2006, in January, and he had a very nice talk with the Chinese counterpart. Unfortunately, China does not have an energy ministry. Very interesting. The energy affairs is led by the Office of Reform and Development. And he had a very very important talk with the Chinese counterpart, Mr. Ma Kai. Ma Kai is now his state counselor. And the two sides reached a very important agreement in terms of cooperation in energy area and stressed the importance of cooperation. And we believe that whenever or wherever in any places, including Africa, if there is any chance for both Chinese and India companies to cooperate, then the two sides should conduct necessary consultation before going to the international bidding. This statement is very interesting because wherever and whenever there is a possibility to cooperate, we do it. But what if there is no possibility? That's the trouble. The trouble is, the reality is that because we are the newcomers, and therefore in many places, perhaps the opportunity for cooperation is very slim, very slight. So in this context, I think the companies have to compete. have to compete. But I think the competition should be based on the market rule. That is fair, should be fair. But Indians always complain that the Chinese companies are not fair or that kind of things. They say they use in Angola, we promise to build up loads of hospitals and the Indian companies don't have this capacity or that kind of things. But anyway, competition, in the competition, all the companies would use all the means. And finally, about India's advancement in technology, especially in military technology. I'm sure, of course, the Chinese are fully aware of this advancement, and we understand, we also read a lot of rhetoric in the Indian media about the so-called China threat. Last year, they launched a nuclear a missile test of Agni 3, and then the Indian media, all the Indian media said that the coverage, including Shanghai and Beijing, it's unnecessary. You know, it's unnecessary, but it's leading to kind of negative response from the Chinese. But in the end of the day, I would argue that there is no possibility for the two countries to jump into a real arms race. That is not possible. And China does not perceive India as a major threat. Hopefully, India would not do the same thing. You know, I think the arms race is too harmful to the two nations. And finally, about the democracy. Well, three democracies, the largest democracy, and China, India, and the United States, that's the three most populous countries, right? If all the three countries become a democracy, that would be good. But China is not going to copy American model. I'm sorry to say. And China does not believe that American model is the only demonstration of a democracy either. We believe democracy might be demonstrated through other ways. And we also learn a lot from Singapore and from the development of South Korea and other things, because we have a very specific culture. And also, finally, I would say, I do not believe that India's democracy is a similar thing as that of the United States. Thank you.
Answering these questions, because I think some of them have been dealt with. I was fascinated by the professor's answer to the question about Pakistan. I would think that my friend Mawahid might be having heart failure over the idea that India and China should cooperate in figuring out how to address Pakistan's problems. I think that may not have been what you had in mind. On a more serious note, there have been times when the U.S. was actively engaged in India-Pakistan diplomacy and sounded out China to see whether it was interested in somehow helping to set the environment for India and Pakistan to move ahead on Kashmir, and China was always very interested in staying out of any such discussions. So I'm not sure how the Pakistan factor is going to play. China's position has actually shifted over the years. It had been four square behind Pakistan on the Kashmir question for a long time, and then it shifted to a more even-handed position during the Kargil crisis. China made it pretty clear, although they were more subtle about it than we were, for example, that they thought Pakistan should clear out of the Kargil area. So the real question there is whether China sees its interests in encouraging an India-Pakistan settlement of some sort, or whether it sees its interest in making sure that Pakistan can still play some kind of a counterweight role. And I'm frankly not sure where that's going. On energy, I love all this cooperation jazz, but I continue to believe that when it comes to specific deals, India and China are going to be rivals, not partners. In the particular Angola case, I don't believe there was that much response from the Indians, except for perhaps a little bit of gnashing of teeth. But the real question there is to what extent India's policy, which basically stresses diversification of energy supplies above all else, to what extent will India seek to accomplish this diversification by deal making and to what extent by the market. And there isn't going to be one policy answer, because the policy answer is going to be everything we can. Military competition. I think the key lies in the final statement that he made: China does not see India as a threat. I hope India doesn't see China as a threat. But the reality is that the Indian security establishment does see China as a potential threat. It's only the most hawkish who see it as a more current threat. And what they, I mean, I don't think it's correct to say that if you abolished newspapers, you would have no problems. I don't think you actually meant that, but that's always the temptation when there's a public statement that makes you go. But what the Indian security establishment worries about is Chinese access to various potential military facilities around the Indian Ocean. I'm sure you've heard the phrase string of pearls. I know that a lot of people feel that these worries are exaggerated. I'm only saying that the worries exist. And finally, the values and democracy question. I have two comments here. First of all, I don't know of any country that has completely copied somebody else's model for democracy. Certainly the U.S. version has some features that I actually haven't seen anyplace else, like the separation of power, and that has disadvantages as well as advantages. But India and the United States have, from the start, had as a great bond the fact that they passionately believed in having their own government run by democratic elections and, as much as possible, democratic governance in between time. This is with the exception of the 2 years of the emergency. However, first of all, this has been the case for 61 years, and during the first 50 or so years of this period, we had a very thin and unsubstantive relationship between India and the United States. My view is that the bond of democracy becomes a really important element in a bilateral relationship when you have other interests in common as well. That's what makes me optimistic about the future of U.S.-India relations, because that is what's developing now. The second point, of course, is that the United States is also a believer, at least in theory, in democracy promotion. How much the U.S. believes in this in practice turns out to vary quite a lot, depending on time and place. India basically has not looked on democracy as an export product, so that the whole idea of making the world more democratic in a general sense is something that Indians and Americans can talk about, you know, late at night over a beer or a Coke or whatever, and pizza and samosas. But so far, at least, they have not had an easy time working in that field, because the whole agenda makes India feel slightly uncomfortable. I think part of the reason for this is that India's view of sovereignty is still a rather stern view, which was forged in the colonial experience. Our colonial experience is 200 years ago.
Well, I forgot to mention at the outset that Professor Zhao has written a paper on Chindi. If you failed to take one when you came in, we probably have more outside. And if not, it is posted on the CSIS website. And please join me in thanking Professor Zhao Guansheng and Ambassador Schaefer.